Hello, and welcome back to Tabling the Podcast. My name is Ariana Karp, and this week, Tabling did a very special episode with the Upstart Crows of Santa Fe, a youth Shakespeare group in New Mexico that does uncut Shakespeare for kids age 10 to 18. They discussed their recent production of King Henry IV, Part 1. I interviewed the young actors and directors about their characters, linguistic footprints, and the challenges of the play. The participants in this episode are Jackson Budolf, Sterling White, Liam Mitchell, Isaac Mariner, Zoe Mariner, Olivia White, Anna Farkas, Joy Farkas, Carol Farkas, and Madeline Philpott. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode of Tabling King Henry IV, Part 1, with the Upstart Crows. Hello and welcome back to Tabling the Podcast. My name is Ariana Karp, and this week I am joined by
Jackson Budolf,
Sterling White,
Liam Mitchell,
Isaac Mariner,
Zoe Mariner,
Olivia White,
Anna Farkas,
Joy Farkas,
Carol Farkas,
and Madeline Philpott.
Thank you all so much for being here. So I am here with the Upstart Crows of Santa Fe, some of them anyway, and they just completed this summer a production of Henry IV, Part 1, which, as our listeners know, is what we have been releasing over the last couple weeks. So basically, I wanted to talk to these wonderful kids about what were your impressions of the play? What struck you about this play? Were there any particular challenges that you faced? And do you like the play? In very simple terms.
I'm just gonna jump in here. As one of the directors, having done this play multiple times, and I see if you guys agree with this, it's one of the most fun plays to be in because it's got tavern scenes, it's got sword fights, it's got, there's so many different phases that you go through.
It's kind of got everything.
It does.
You get to stand on a table.
You love how you stage it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I talked about it in the podcast, I talked about it as something that was, it's kind of like, it shows you an encyclopedic look at England at the time. So you go from all these different worlds, right? You go from the court to a brothel to a tavern to the battlefield to the middle of Wales to Shrewsbury. I mean, it goes all over the place, and you really get the full sort of population, all classes. And that's, I think, really what I love about this play. When you go to Richard II, there's a lot less variation. The entire play is in verse. It's really just about the nobles. There's a scene with the gardeners, but even the gardeners speak in verse. So Henry IV, Part 1 is a really interesting play, and it's sort of encyclopedic nature. So was there anything, any particular challenges that you faced with this play as opposed to any plays that you may have done previously?
Accents. Can I just say accents?
Accents were very hard. I can attest to this. I played the Carrier and the Douglas, and so I had to
and
do
Lendauer.
Like a and Lendauer. Yeah, I forgot to mention. And so I had to do a Welsh, a Scottish, and Lord Crush British, and it was hard for me to learn those.
That's sure. Yeah, no, accents are, but it, that again, it's because we see all of the kingdom, right? And that's what's so wonderful and also so challenging about it. Yeah, Jackson.
I think it was definitely more challenging because it was my first Shakespeare play, so I had to like learn all the English and what all the words meant. So I think it was definitely a challenge.
Just getting your head around.
Yeah, just getting like all the.
Yeah. I agree with that. I thought I was fluent in Old English last year, but when we did a Shakespeare unit, but I'm not.
Well, and it's wonderful. I think the best way to learn about Shakespeare is obviously, as opposed to reading about him, it's reading out loud and performing, and that's how you really get a sense of what the plays are about. So, for you, what is this play about? Who's the main character?
There's really like a set of main characters.
Yeah.
There's like a main character, like in a narrative.
Yeah. But the main character would probably be Hal.
Because most of the story is about him, because
also about Hotspur and King Henry, but I think a lot of it is based on Hal.
Here's the way I see it.
It's kind of Hal's redeeming.
Hal is the hero, the protagonist. Hotspur is the antagonist. And Falstaff is the anti-hero. Falstaff is somewhere in between those two.
That's very interesting.
He's very insightful.
It's also a little bit more than a 2D story with just a hero, a villain, and a foil.
Definitely.
Absolutely, because I think when you get to Act 5, you're rooting for both Hal and Hotspur.
Yeah.
In a way that you don't in a lot of other Shakespeare things. Like, in Romeo and Juliet, who's voting for Tybalt? Like, who's like, yeah, Tybalt, kill Mercutio.
To be honest.
Like, come on. Well, besides you. I mean, Tybalt is kind of an asshole, and we don't really like him that much.
Yeah.
And he always picks fights, and he's very fiery and hot. But with Hotspur, who is also a bit choleric, we sort of love Hotspur as well. And I think that's the genius of this play, is really there's kind of two heroes. But interestingly enough, you know, you said it's about Prince Hal. I think there's so many different titles. Like, if you had to come up with a title for this play that wasn't Henry IV Part 1, what would it be? I have a couple ideas. Hotspur versus Hal.
The old English play.
I have one that's very long, which is The Education of Prince Hal, The Rebellion of Hotspur, and The Antics of Sir John Falstaff. And King Henry IV looks back and feels guilty. That to me is like, those are the four biggest characters in the play.
You know, I think one of the things about Hal and the redemption story is it's nuanced enough that it's not a simple prodigal son story.
Yeah.
It's not like Hal's the dissolute and then over the course of the play he becomes this upright heir to the throne. There's so much about him that is kind of fishy.
Remains fishy. And remains too. And
yes.
Critics and audiences throughout the performance history have had a lot of trouble really completely liking Hal, which I think is really interesting, because I think I saw a quite dreadful production where Hal was played as completely Machiavellian. By that I mean he didn't express any affection for Falstaff at all. He didn't seem like he even liked Falstaff, and to me that's such a sort of one-dimensional, like literally not even two-dimensional but one-dimensional reading of the play, because to me it's like Hal's not making any sacrifice unless he really likes Falstaff, right? Unless he loves Falstaff, there's nothing of value for him to reject. He's not losing anything when he rejects him. And I think, you know, obviously it happens in part two, but that the rejection of Falstaff is such a, I think it's like the saddest moment in Shakespeare. And there's a lot of sad moments in Shakespeare, but
and yet you laugh about it.
Yeah, no, it's true, but it's of all the things that, you know, could happen. You know, you could be talking about the scene with Lady Macduff getting killed and the son to Macduff getting killed in Macbeth, and that's a horrifying scene, but there's something so heartbreaking about a friendship that is sort of breaking apart. Olivia, you played Falstaff. So obviously that's a challenging role for many reasons. How was your experience playing Falstaff?
That was really difficult, honestly, because I just didn't know how to approach him at all, because he's completely different from how I am, and I just didn't know how to approach him, because, I mean, I'm a 17-year-old girl, he's a 60-year-old man. It's like, I can't find much to relate to him, except for his friendship with Hal, and sort of how he interacts with other people, where he's very people-focused, he talks a lot, and that's something that I think that's where we connected, where I could find myself in the character.
And very, very rude to the hostess.
Well, said the hostess.
Yeah. That's not exactly a connection point, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's interesting, you say, playing different, you're obviously playing a different gender, you're playing a different age, those are some of the other challenges. For those of you who are guys and are playing guys, what were some of the challenges that you faced playing the characters? Besides accents, of course.
Oh, yeah, accents were pretty major. I mean, for me personally, I had a kind of hard time becoming, like, really mad. Because for Glendower, I kind of have to become a little, you know, upset or that. But it's, you know, kind of contained, so it's really, you know, kind of a weird spot for me. Mm. I'm usually one or the other. I can't be, like, kind of in between, like, slowly getting mad. No, I'm always just mad from the start. And then with the Douglas, that was kind of hard to play him for, you know, crazy Scott, essentially.
Yeah. With the kilt, too.
With the kilt.
Very important detail. Anyone else have any thoughts about challenges with any of the roles?
Alright, so I played Hotspur, and one of the hard parts of that was kind of his motivation, like what's driving him to do this, and that's kind of like the straight motivation of his uncle's kind of convincing him and his father to take the crown, basically, but just kind of, he has a deeper level to that, and getting there and kind of figuring out what's going on inside of his head was really difficult, and then... It's hard to approach just kind of his emotions throughout the whole thing because he's really changeable. He goes from one thing to the other in a split second. And in many scenes, he's got really angry to being kind of joking and humorous to kind of a middle ground. And it's really hard to go from playing characters like Leontes in The Winter's Tale, which is just anger all the time, or Brutus, which is like flat. to this, which is kind of a mix of all of it, and you have to be playing everything equally, and that was really challenging for me. But
well, I know we had fun in the Lady Kate scene with you because we tried it lots of different ways, and we kind of workshopped it a little bit. You know, what if she was domineering? What if she was scared of her?
Oh, I remember when we worked. I actually think I brought that up when we were doing acts. Two, is it? Act two? Yeah, there we go. But I brought up that idea that maybe Hotspur, the only thing he's afraid of is his wife. Like, he's not afraid of anything else. He is afraid of his wife. So, that could be an interesting...
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of pressure on that scene, too, because I don't think we have anyone from the pros who played any of the women. But there's so few women in... Well, we've got
Lady Mortimer,
who doesn't speak English. but there are so few women in the plays. I mean, you've got Lady Kate, who really, you know, she's a very small part, but it has this huge effect because it shows us the other side of Hotspur. Without that, there's something definitely missing. But it puts a huge amount of pressure on that scene to carry a lot, and I think that's one of the more challenging scenes for both those characters.
Did you decide? I can't remember, Sterling. I know that Elizabeth's Hotspur was, there was more romance between the two, but yours was less so, as I recall.
To some degree, it kind of started off that way, and kind of as I got more into it, changed a bit. It's kind of, he might not have been into it at first, but now he's kind of found a connection.
Right.
And then he just doesn't want her to deal with this, so he's kind of stepping back and like, you don't joke, kind of throws some jokes there.
So does he not want her to deal with it because he really believes that stuff he says when he says, you know, you're a woman, I'll only trust you so far, and or is that him just bantering at her and he just doesn't want her to get involved in that brutal world of battle?
I think kind of maybe half and half. It's very much kind of the medieval, you know, knight character. I mean,
last
a little
chivalrous.
Yeah, and to some degree he thinks that, like, his place is on the battlefield. He's uncomfortable in the situation. He's uncomfortable being kind of in this, like, backstabbing kind of political... It's not so much there, but, like, with her, she's trying to convince him to tell her stuff, and he's just... doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to deal with that kind of stuff. He wants to go off and hit something with a sword.
Absolutely.
Not
well,
very
and I think
gentle.
That goes to what you were talking about of him having just changing at the drop of a hat and being very changeable. And I mean, I think as humans, we are very changeable. It's hard to play a character that's sort of so mercurial, for lack of a better word.
It's funny, though, because he's so sure in his decisions. I mean, he never changes his mind about anything. Once he's settled on something, he doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to
But yeah. There's an interesting exception to that at the end of the play when he and Douglas come in and they say, we'll fight with him tonight. By the end of the scene, Hotspur says, okay, fine, we'll fight with him tomorrow. And that was something during the reading I was like, oh my God, I never really realized. He actually does a complete change and decides, I don't know why, maybe my Blunts can tell me a little bit why. After hearing Blunt, Sir Walter Blunt speak, that Hotspur changes his mind and decides to go along with Worcester and Vernon. We don't have any Worcesters here, do we?
No.
I love that character. I'm totally obsessed with that character. Fifth largest character in the play. And I think he's sort of the mirror image of Henry, in a way. They're both these very, very smart political minds. And they're very modern characters. Whereas I think Falstaff, for example, is like a very old, archaic character. Let me hear from my Blunts about... what did you find... Blunt is a very interesting character. What were some challenges or what were some observations about him?
Well, he's an interesting character because he has a few scenes... Even though his very few scenes, he all expresses lots of emotions in them, except for like the first one because he's just standing there.
That's true.
But, I mean, the other one, like where he has his speeches and stuff, it's never really easy to pinpoint where his emotions are because in that first scene where he talks, he saves Hotspur from getting reprimanded by King Henry.
Yeah.
About the prisoners.
Kind of.
Yeah, but mostly. And so he makes the decision for King Henry to kind of turn his end to save Hotspur from something.
The wrath.
Consequences.
So I think, and then in his end speech where he comes to like the rebel camp, and that's a very interesting speech because there's just some lines where he's like, you need to do this or else. Then there's also some lines where he's like, I can't believe that you did this. I mean, like, what drives you? So he's a very interesting character.
So did you feel, I mean, this is what I felt when I played him, that he was a very honorable man.
Yeah, he seemed like he was, like a counselor, and he was always honest. And, yeah, that's what struck me about Blunt, anyway.
Straight guy.
Yeah. And Hotspur even praises him. Like, would to God your name... Mm. That's the wrong line. But it's the line of where he's like...
Blunt's.
Would to God you were of our determination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us love you well, and even though some...
Everyone has respect for him. Which is very interesting. And he dies for the king. In the king's...
Except for Douglas, he doesn't have respect for him.
Yeah,
Douglas was the one. He doesn't have respect for anybody.
Isaac, tell me a little bit about Douglas and what the experience was playing him.
Well, it was interesting because he's an older version of Hotspur. and in that, he's more well-controlled. Somewhat.
Not really.
But in the scene you were just talking about, he tells Hotspur, you should go and fight with him tonight. You really should, because it's a good idea.
Catch him unawares? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
No such word of fear where I come from.
I know.
And then you run off the stage and how holds a dagger in your throat.
Indeed. Well,
that's
a choice,
moment.
Too.
That's a hard moment. I mean, having Douglas, I felt the same. Like, why am I running?
Yeah,
after all the stuff I said.
Yeah.
The king was right there. I could have turned around and stabbed it.
When Blunt speaks, you feel like there's no hidden agenda going on. Blunt's like, what he says is what he is. And then Douglas pulls that stunt where he just leans.
I think maybe on some degree it might be because Douglas has some sense of honor.
Yeah.
So like, he knows when he's beaten, and so Hal's kind of... So in... Hal's kind of... almost... What's the word? Tricked him, I guess, into kind of beating Douglas, but he has beaten Douglas, and so Douglas kind of realizes that. It's like, there's no point in trying to, like, kill the king in some backhanded fashion. He'd much rather have just a straight fight.
Yeah.
And so he... I mean, running away isn't the most honorable thing, but it is more honorable than killing a king while he's down when His son has his knife to your throat. So you know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's funny. When I played Prince Hal for the first time, I had this epic Douglas fight, which was so unsafe because it involved flying swords. So I remember it was like part of it. I would like hit Douglas's sword up as hard as I could, and then I would catch it, and it was like both of them were at his throat. So he had no weapon at that point, which was why he left. I caught it 75% of the time. Sometimes it would hit Douglas in the head. It was a very badly choreographed
sword fight. Did bad things happen at the productions?
No, it was just it was just I think we were a little bit more ambitious than our skill set at the time. And flying swords, I think, is never a terribly good idea. But that's another challenge of these plays, right? Is how many sword fights there are. I mean, most plays only have one big sword fight. King Lear, you get Edgar and Oswald, and then you get Edgar and Edmund, which is this big epic fight setup. But for Henry, you have an entire battle scene where you have how many fights is it? It's like four or five.
You've got Douglas and Henry. You've got
Douglas and Blunt.
Henry and Hotspur. And I've done it before where the one with Douglas was an actual long fight as well.
Yeah, the Falstaff.
And Falstaff falling over.
It was fun.
But so that's a lot on top of. You know, already the challenges of a production, that's sort of a technical thing that's very difficult, as well as learning all the tavern songs, which is, of course, really fun, but there's so many elements that sort of fit together with Henry IV. I just want to talk a little bit about the beginning of the play, and what do you guys, I know I don't have any Henry IV's here, but what did you make of that first scene? What is sort of happening?
Yeah, Jack.
Well, it's a really interesting scene because it's so many speeches, all these long speeches. I'd say it's a hard scene because you have to hook the audience because it's the first scene, but also you have to make these really long speeches. So
a lot of exposition.
Yeah.
Much of which the audience has no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
For me, the first scene was just boring because I didn't understand Old English.
Well, and that's a fair point. It's funny. You know, I've been in the play 3 times, and it wasn't until we did the tabling cold read of that scene that I understood this whole section of Henry's speech that had never really clicked for me before. And I was like, oh, this is all about pilgrimage. This is all about the Crusades. I get it!
And
you know,
he's setting up themes that keep replaying. Because, I mean, it starts with him not having control over his own decisions, having to sacrifice things because of what's needed of a king. And I think this stuff kind of continues to play out. Because he's being forced into a position that he doesn't want.
Absolutely. Well, and he has to fight civil war his entire reign. You know, there's always uprisings. There's uprisings in both plays that are very significant and that have a huge effect on the whole kingdom. I think it's really telling, and it's always very chilling to me when I see Henry IV Part 2, what he tells Hal when he's dying is, fight foreign wars. You will never unite your kingdom more than when you have a foreign enemy. Which I think, you know, as we see in modern history, a lot of, you know, our own presidents have done that as well.
It's like you have a war on your own terms, otherwise it's going to come in a way you don't want it.
And I think there were two tiny, tiny rebellions that involved about 3 people during Henry V's reign. Other than that, he is and remains. England was never more united than they were under Henry V. So I think that's a very interesting turn from total civil war throughout Richard II and Henry IV, both parts of Henry IV. Into a sort of, definitely not a time of peace, but a time of national unification. All of the nobles.
And uneasy truce.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone went off to France and they fought and against ridiculous odds, they won. And, you know, but then it all went topsy-turvy because Henry's son was definitely not the same kind of king that he was, and could not unite the kingdom. And civil war, once again.
I think we were really
fun.
Blessed in our Henrys in this production because they were so clear about
wonderful.
Those first speeches. And I think we got our Westmorlands eventually to describe the war atrocities in a way that was effective.
I did some research about what that actually was. It's
really,
absolutely
really
disgusting. And we already talked about it in great detail, and I don't want to talk about it here. But it's pretty remarkable what Westmorland is saying the Welsh women did to the bodies of the soldiers.
Right.
It's grass! But then we go from the court of the king, and as we sort of, I always like to think of this play as very cinematic. It's like we sort of zoom through the streets of London to some tavern where Falstaff is asleep, and Hal comes. And what do you make of that first scene? There's a lot of really tricky language in for both Falstaff and Hal, a lot of really archaic metaphors. What do you make of that first scene? What did it sort of tell you about Falstaff and about his relationship with Hal?
Well, Olivia had them the minute she fell off the bench when he woke her up.
Slapstick is always good. Always good.
I need to look at it again.
Well, so Hal has that great, big, long speech about how, you don't care what time of day it is. And it really is, it always seems to me like it's a bit overkill. It's like, you could have just said, why do you care? But he doesn't. He launches into this huge thing about sack and Cavon and wenches and flame-colored taffeta.
Uh-huh.
And
everything
you need to know about Falstaff right there.
Yeah, I mean, it really tells you a lot about what Falstaff's vices are.
Sack admits Cavon's legs.
Exactly.
And sung herself
a fair hot wench in flame-colored taffeta.
And the blessed son.
Yeah.
Son.
Mm-hmm.
The blessed son himself, I think. But yeah, it does tell you a lot about Falstaff. But what do you make of, how do you think they became friends? This is something I've always
That's a big question.
Well,
like, how do you think, I have this new theory that Poins is actually is not a commoner,
the third son, yeah,
you know, of a minor noble or something.
Minor noble.
He's
in the court, and he probably met, Hal when he was tiny.
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny child.
Because everyone hates him so much,
yeah.
And he gets on well with how they stay together for so long.
Yeah. But I had this idea that, Prince Hal was like, I want to go and hang out with the real people. And Poins was like, I know this tavern where everyone hates me. Let's go! And then, Hal met Falstaff, and the rest was history.
Yeah.
You know? Because I know you guys did this when in the tavern scene, Falstaff goes, you know, banish Bardolph, and everyone's like, no! Banish Pedo, no! Banish Poins! Banish Poins! You know? And that's, a great... I think that's a wonderful thing, because, of course, everyone doesn't feel the same way about everyone. But I think it's really funny if people are kind of jealous of the closeness that Poins and Hal have. But did you have any thoughts about why they became friends or what about anyone really?
I mean, I think, it could have been a certain deal, like you've said, Poins took him to the tavern, and I feel like he just kind of naturally latched on to Falstaff for whatever reason.
Yeah.
He saw something really weird in him. And he didn't like his father very much the whole time, and I think he naturally kind of became a father figure for him.
Absolutely.
You know?
Hal was in a kind of uncomfortable position, wasn't he, because he was born before his father was king.
Yes.
So he grew
That's
up
right,
now as a
yeah.
prince, and then suddenly this whole thing happens.
He also has three other brothers as well, which is pretty... it's great security for King Henry to have four sons. I mean, that's kind of basically unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
What Henry VIII would have given for four sons, you know? He would have had, 12 more wives, you know? But it's always interesting to me, what must that have been like growing up as, a pretty high noble, but then having your father banished, but then come back and then take over the kingdom, and then you're the heir apparent, you were never born to it, really, and it's just very interesting.
Well, here's a question. So is it something about Falstaff's language that appeals to Hal?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he uses words... to say whatever he wants them to say. He's very good at making language slippery, and maybe that's appealing to Hal. because he's looking for outs all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
I think Falstaff is very intelligent, and he manipulates language so well, and Tal is also the same sort of zone. So Falstaff is completely different than his father, and I think that's what appeals to him, where it's like, here's this guy who epitomizes, like, fun, basically, and Hal's young, and he wants to go do other things, and so he's drawn to Falstaff because he's just so different, but yet so articulate and interesting.
That's really interesting that you talk about that intelligence, and I think Falstaff is such a warm character, right? Even though he's kind of a scoundrel, you just can't not love him. You know, he's just so delightful.
I respectfully disagree.
Really, you don't like Falstaff?
Said the hostess.
You've got
the hostess, of course. Yeah.
The hostess likes Falstaff until you know it's gotten that his debts are so bad that. But tell me about the hostess, Madeline.
The hostess is. Doesn't seem much like a complicated character. Mainly because, I mean, most of it's just silent acting.
A lot of it's silent acting. Yeah, but I mean, that also means there can be a whole universe going on in silent acting as well. You know, I think she's got she's a wonderful presence in the tavern.
She's,
and just her delight.
She's a very
with all
nice,
the things.
Happy person.
Oh, she likes
she
his play.
Is.
Right.
Yeah.
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 So
yeah.
The play.
That was.
Dude, I stand for my father.
I think the hostess actually kind of likes Falstaff because he draws in all these people to her tavern.
Yeah.
So he's good for the
business. Yeah. That's a wonderfully materialistic explanation. I love it.
Until he's talking about how somebody pickpocketed her and pickpocketed him. I thought it was the hostess.
And then he has that wonderful line when she hasn't done anything wrong, and he goes, "Hostess, I forgive thee." And she's like, "What? What? I didn't do anything." No,
what
that's a wonderful moment.
I did nothing. I just yelled at you because you were mad at me.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
She does take care of him. She gets him the good shirts.
She
not
does.
Not the filthy dowels that he says they are, but good shirts.
Dozen of shirts.
There's Holland.
Dowels. Filthy dowels.
Now, here's an idea about Falstaff. He's a knight, so
he's Sir John Falstaff.
He could be something mildly related to points.
Oh, God.
That might explain why points doesn't like him.
Those relatives.
It also makes you wonder if that's the case. How is points like? Because I just have this tiny headcanon running in my head where points like after the entire. Hal goes off to war and comes back like a changed person, kind of.
Yeah.
Like they stuck together because Poins is kind of the only person, if he is a son of like a knight or like a lower noble, he'd be the only one from the past life that Hal could really hang on to without social disgrace or a lot of not good things happening.
But
that's true.
What happened
to
Poins?
If Poins isn't in,
he's not in part two.
So
he is in part two.
Oh,
he is in part two.
Yeah.
They play another trick on Falstaff in the other tavern scene in part two.
Another one?
And yeah, and he has a whole scene. Prince Hal's first scene in part two is with Poins. The way they did in the Hollow Crown, they're like at baths, and they're like,
yeah.
And Hal is like, "Oh, I'm so sad." And Poins is like, "Get out of here." It's really funny, actually. It's very much a, in sooth, I know not why I am so sad kind of moment for Prince Hal at the beginning of part two, which I think is very interesting. But yeah, interestingly, Poins is there, but then Poins disappears again. Like a lot of the tavern folk disappear. So we've talked about the tavern and the tavern dynamics. Were there any, how about my Bardolphs here and Pedos and Poins and Gadshills?
Bardolph the red-nosed drunkard.
Bardolph the red-nosed drunkard, absolutely. But what was your experience playing those characters as opposed to the nobles? I always think you've got to double cast with these. And Blunt Bardolph works so well. And like Westmoreland Pedo, you know, whatever it is.
Westmoreland and Pedo were absolutely the same person.
We didn't double cast that one, but we did do Blunt and Bardolph.
Blunt and Bardolph. I think it makes such a great character combo. But can my Bardolphs talk a bit about what's going on with Bardolph, who is probably my favorite of the hangers on?
I think he really likes Falstaff. He wants to be a lot like Falstaff, but he's not quite. So, I mean, he wants to be Falstaff, but he's not. So,
because he's incapable of it, or because he's scared?
Well, he's not a knight.
He's
not quite as charming.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I got.
And how is he? How is he different from Blunt?
I don't think Blunt is a coward. I think Barnolf is at least a little bit of a coward.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And yeah, I don't think he's quite as honest as Blunt either.
No.
Blunt is really honest, and Barnolf's just not. He's
gonna grab the trap. Yeah, you tickle our roses with spear grass and.
Yes.
To make him bleed.
And the slumber of Gramus was going to swear it was the blood of true men.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Jackson, did you have any thoughts about Bardolph?
I don't know. It's kind of interesting having the double cast of Blunt and Bardolph because they're kind of like the opposite of each other. Like,
yeah.
All the good qualities that Blunt has, Bardolph doesn't have them. Like, yeah, or like they're lesser.
Yeah.
In the robbery scene, he runs away.
Yeah.
They all run away.
Well, yeah, they all run away.
He has that. He does have that wonderful moment at the beginning of the second tavern scene where, you know, Falstaff's like,
yes,
did
yeah.
I, Bardolph? And Bardolph's like,
yeah.
Indeed, Sir John, you said so. And it's such a great, and I just feel like Falstaff is like, how dare you, my dear red-nosed friend, how very dare you give me up to Prince Hal? But I always love that moment. It's like Bardolph's one redeeming moment of honesty.
Bardolph
and Blunt, they could be
long-lost
brothers.
You're making all these weird ties here.
I think creating the fan fiction
related.
Background for End of the Fourth Part 1. I love it.
Let's talk to Anastasia about this.
So, we have... Tell me a bit more about the world of chivalry and the world of the rebellion. So we have Hotspur and we have Douglas. And we have Vernon, who I find to be a fabulous character. He has those great speeches. His voice is on his thighs. Gallop the armed! It's such a great rose from the ground like feathered mercury. I love that line. That line is so amazing.
Charlotte nailed that.
Such a, yeah, it's a great.
I love
great,
that that's the god they compare him to.
Yeah.
To just.
Mercury. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's very telling too,
it's
right?
It's not Apollo or Jove,
it's Mercury. So tell me a bit more about the relationship between, so we talked a little bit about Hotspur and a little bit about Douglas, and Glendower. So what's the relationship between these guys? Because the rebellion, you never really see them sort of united. They're always fighting. What do you think their ultimate goal is, or do they all have different goals?
I think they all have different goals. They're all trying, kind of, they don't like the king, they don't like having king to power, so they're trying to dethrone him.
But they were deposed, and they were the ones that put him on the throne.
Yeah.
They don't like what he did.
But they don't like what
right,
he did.
But he did, like, it doesn't matter if they put him on the throne. They now see that he wasn't he wasn't what they wanted. He wasn't what they thought he was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they don't want him there anymore. But all of them have kind of these different characteristics, these different traits that make them incompatible with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Hotspur with Glendower, there's that great scene that you have between them. And you get this feeling that Hotspur just—he doesn't really enjoy interacting with, being around Glendower, but
mm-hmm.
he has to do it so he can get support.
Seems like Hotspur doesn't like being around anyone.
That I disagree. With
no,
that, but that's a
different conversation.
Yeah,
so I was not talking about that.
But he won't do the whole, you know, I'll be polite and civil and practice
right.
court etiquette.
Because that's not Hotspur. Hotspur's not the kind of person
right.
to go with what he should do. He goes with kind of Hotspurs of the moment, you know. He's very much a act-as-he-feels kind of person. And
play it by ear.
Not really, but kind of.
And Worcester and Vernon know how to trip his trigger. They know how
right.
to send
oh,
him
yes.
to his chivalric place.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And
yeah.
he comes from that place of chivalry, and he's got kind of that base, but he kind of takes it in a different route than you would see. And it's interesting, because in the beginning of the play, he's seen as this gallant knight,
mm-hmm.
or all praise knight, as Hal calls him, kind of mockingly. And he's kind of the symbol of chivalry in the beginning, and then when you actually meet him, he's...
he's human.
He's very human, and he's not that picturesque kind of knight in shining armor. Right. He's this regular kind of madman almost. Does what he
the
wants.
The madcap, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a really great point because we keep dealing with the trope mm-hmm. and then the reality, and that's what Shakespeare gives
and
you.
So going way back to when we started, we were talking about heroes and who's the main character and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think it's wrong to think of Hal or anyone as the hero. It's
yeah.
a history
yeah.
play. There isn't a hero. It's just
that's true.
It's describing the events in a dramatical fashion. And playing Hotspur, you get kind of the other side where, for me, Hal's the bad guy. I'm the
absolutely.
Good guy. When I play that role, it's I'm rooting for my side. And Hal, if you like in the play, he's not the picturesque or the ideal king or lord or any
mm-hmm.
of that. He's this like wishy-washy kind of person. Yeah, just
bottom
in
feeder.
The and compared to Hotspur, he doesn't have any of those qualities. In the beginning of the play, the king says like, or no, not in the beginning of the play, there's kind of this idea of the king wishing that Hotspur was his son instead
oh, yeah.
of Hal.
Some
quite a thing to say.
Had exchanged right. them in their crypt and their
yeah.
That's right.
And
the two Henrys, right? That's yeah. the other confusing thing is there's three Henrys.
Right.
They don't
yeah.
have very big parts in this play.
And
yeah.
it's kind of showing you that the person that maybe we're is supposed to or we feel that we should like Hal isn't perfect and there isn't a good way to do like. He's dishonorable, I think. Especially when you see at the end, at the fight between him and Hal. I'm kind of taking this off in a different direction than we were talking about.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
So in that last fight, Hotspur is... You can play it differently, but at the end, a lot of people play it that Hal draws a dagger and kills Hotspur, which is a dishonorable thing. He's not going to keep
yeah.
fighting sword on sword, but he goes kind of... backstabs him almost in a
that's
interesting. Way.
And that's really a very interesting choice, right? Because that's not anywhere in
the
script.
Text,
that's
right.
not in
that
the text
choice.
That it was a dishonorable death. The way I remember the three different sword fights that I had, it was almost like an accident that Hotspur got killed.
Another way to play it.
Which was, it was like, because it was such a long fight, like I've never done a longer fight. It was when Nick was my Hotspur, and he's just he was my second Hotspur, and he was the one who choreographed all the fights, and he was just really, really good with sword fights. But this fight just went on forever. And so by the very end, like, he had gotten kicked in the face, I had gotten smashed in the head with the back of the sword, and we were both just sort of, like, fighting it out just desperately, and there was very little sort of skill or focus because we're both so desperate, and it just so happened that Hal... got him, and then was like totally shocked by what had happened, because I think if you go into the fight, you don't think Hal's gonna win.
No, yeah. For sure.
So that was, I actually really liked doing it that way, because I think the eulogy that he gives to Hotspur, to me, signals, and of course this is from Hal's perspective, but to me signals that he has a lot of respect for him and what he did, and is, you know, he has a lot of moments, both as Hal and also as Henry V, like right before the Battle of Agincourt, where he sort of goes like, what is the point of all this? Like, why are we doing this? This is so, all this fighting is so stupid. And he has these moments, but then you also see him, I think he's both the hero and the anti-hero of Henry V. He has this horrific speech before the gates of Harfleur, where he talks about all of the stuff that they're going to do. And I really think you have to believe that he believes they're going to come in, they're going to storm the town, they're going to raid everything, they're going to kill and do other horrible things to people. And you kind of have to believe that that's what he's going to do. And then he kills all these prisoners because they killed the French... killed the boy. So, you know, it's a very complicated character, because he sort of contains the capacity to both sort of realize the ridiculousness of fighting, but also he turns into a very fierce warrior. I mean, he was called the Warrior King, and I think he learned a lot from the Battle of Shrewsbury. At least when I look at the whole Henriad, I think he had to have learned a lot from Hotspur and Hotspur's military tactics. Because he went on, you know, Hotspur was greatly outnumbered in the Battle of Shrewsbury, but Hal was even more outnumbered at the Battle of Agincourt and somehow managed to win. So it's interesting just to think about the parallels to me between Hal as Henry V and also and Hotspur, and because I see a lot of similarities between the two characters.
Just to go back a little bit to that death scene, you know, and he gives him this beautiful eulogy, but then there's this line, and it always just rings a little bit hollow. Mm. I'll thank myself for doing these fair rites of tenderness.
Mm.
And it's almost as if he's got an eye on posterity.
Yeah.
You know, yes, take your praises with you to heaven, and won't I look good?
Absolutely. Well, the way I explained it was that Henry IV is haunted by the past, and
yeah.
Hal is haunted by the future and the expectations that he has.
Yeah, but I also wonder if maybe, I mean, with that line, I mean, he's seen his father just completely, like, ripped up over the fact that Richard died, and, like, he's constantly
yeah.
praying for his soul, and, like, maybe part of that moment with Hotspur is, like, and
I don't want to be like
I don't
want to
be building chapels
yeah.
for Hotspur in 15 years.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful point. I hadn't thought of that. That's great.
As someone who's played Hal 3 times,
mm-hmm.
why does he have a nickname for his nickname?
What do you mean? Harry?
That's
Hal?
How it works. In
yeah.
England, I swear.
His name is Henry, but also Harry.
And also Hal.
And also Hal. I don't know. I don't know why that is. I think it might be in this play, I think it might be a way of distinguishing all of the different Henrys, because there's King Henry IV, there's Prince Henry, and there's Henry Percy. So it really, it's the way we talk about it is King Henry, Harry Percy, and Prince Hal. They're all just nicknames of the
yeah.
very used
so
as we got up to Henry VIII. So
Falstaff calls him Hal. And I guess
right.
Coins calls him Hal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everyone in the tavern calls
they
him Hal.
And his
tavern
his father... I think his father calls him Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
yes,
his father calls him.
He
does not
and
call him Hal.
Maybe all of this is kind of... It makes it a more... I don't know. It emphasizes the transition in the next plays when he becomes king.
Mm.
And no longer is he Hal or Harry. He's now Henry V. And it's kind
right.
of that truly shows how far he's come.
Yeah,
absolutely.
From drunkard to king. Like.
From drunkard to king.
Yeah.
But I also think of him as sort of the great observer. Like, I have this idea that he... The reason he... Besides enjoying people, because I think that's an essential element that is not always totally played by Hal's. I've seen it actually not played before. That he genuinely enjoys
mm-hmm.
being in the tavern. But I think he's also a great observer of human nature. And he... I think that's part of the reason why... And I think one of the biggest problems that Henry has is he mistakes Hal hanging out in the taverns, his sort of populism for Richard II's popularity contest and like trying to be this
mm-hmm.
popular king. And that they were totally, I mean, Richard II, Lord love him, but he was quite a dreadful elitist and he just hated the common people completely. And, you know, Henry knew how to talk to his soldiers, and you see how that works, you know.
What were you going to say?
I wasn't going to say anything. I was just...
I love Richard II. Richard II is like one of my favorites.
And enjoying the fact that he existed.
Yeah. he's a quite delightful character. I hope you guys get a chance to do Richard II sometime, because it's a glorious play. So were there any other characters or any... other things that you wanted to discuss about this wonderful play?
I mean, kind of going back to, like, the, you know, the whole, you know, Hotspur side, I feel like they're all kind of misfits in one way or another. It's really just kind of last
yes.
minute banded together to go up against something that they all dislike in one way or another.
And Liam, I think you don't feel that unless you're in the scenes and you really,
yeah.
you get what all those tensions are and how you know they're never going to fit together.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
It's kind of like the stuffed animal of a 5-year-old man. It's a real patchwork.
A patchwork? A patchwork rebellion.
Worcester is a patchwork dog. You'll have to tell Roman that.
Yeah.
it's so important, I think, to their side that they're abandoned by most of their allies.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's just Hotspur, the Douglas, and a couple others. And
the Archbishop
father,
and Sir
right.
Michael? What a motley crew.
Right?
Yeah.
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 The whole thing.
The same thing happens
Michael,
the second time around.
I don't understand how all these things go together, because I wasn't in the rebellion so much.
Yeah, well, and that's such an interesting scene, right? The one with the Archbishop and Sir Michael.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time we see anyone from that is not from a secular order, right? We see these two people from the church discussing the rebellion.
They're actually compatible with each other.
Yeah, that's true. They don't fight in that scene, do they?
They don't try to kill each other. They're actually reassuring each other that they
take these letters
okay.
Quick, the roof's falling in.
Yeah, absolutely.
But trust me, things are going to be fine.
Right.
But then they
Jackson,
aren't.
You had something you were going to say.
Yeah, like the rebellion's kind of like a puzzle that is missing pieces.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of like a little kid put the whole puzzle together and he's missing, like the dog chewed up a bunch of them or the cat took one to like his.
Is that maybe because there isn't like a central thing that they're gathering around? I mean, with the rebellion against Richard, you had Henry Bolingbroke, and he's kind of like a focal point for everything. And with this, it's Hotspur's leading the war, but they're going to put Mortimer on the throne, but Worcester's really more organizing it, and it's...
And Hotspur's been manipulated
and,
by
there's no like strong center to the thing that people can gather around. It's just...
People aren't focused around one idea. It's just scattered ideas all over the place.
This is another idea. Back into the scene where where you have Glendower and Harry Percy and Mortimer and Worcester. Really, right there are the four people who are working hard on the rebellion. They're plotting and planning. And Mortimer is the one trying to keep the peace.
Yeah.
Right. Which is depicted in this speech, which I'll let Mortimer. Mortimer.
Mortimer's not reading. How about the other Mortimer?
Which one?
Mortimer speech.
Which one?
Or the...
Yeah,
Archdeacon.
Archdeacon? Yeah, I guess.
Oh.
Ooh, and I have something to say about this speech. So, who wants to read it?
Jackson's going
to
read it.
The Archdeacon hath divided into three limits very equally. England from Trent and Severn hitherto, by south and east, is to my part assigned. All westward, Wales beyond the Severn shore, and all the fertile land within that bound to Owen Glendower. And dear cuz, to you, the remnant northward lying off from Trent. And on dentures tripartite are drawn, which being sealed interchangeably, a business that this night may execute. Tomorrow, cousin Percy, you and I, and my good lord of Worcester will set forth to meet your father in the Scottish power, and this is appointed us at Shrewsbury. My father Glendower is not ready yet, nor shall we need his help these 14 days. From that space, you may have drawn together your tenants, friends, and neighboring gentlemen.
Great. Yeah.
Which doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Which doesn't happen, but also I was re-looking at King Lear, which is my favorite play of all time. But if you look at the beginning, and this is goes to something that I know some of you were at the workshop that Rodney Cottier taught about that. The danger is it's not a normal thing what King Lear is doing. He's dividing the kingdom. Bad idea. Bad idea. And I think we see that. I think this was a really scary idea to Elizabethans, dividing the kingdom, right? And we see that in this scene with Glendower and Mortimer is about dividing the kingdom into different parts. And this kingdom, which had somewhat been united, being divided up into England, Wales, and Northern England / Scotland, essentially. And sort of what the danger is, you know, maybe the moral of the tale is you know, it's dangerous to divide a kingdom. Mm-hmm. And this was written during Elizabeth's reign, but all of the Jacobean plays, which were written during James the First's reign, his whole big idea was unifying, and the idea of United Kingdom and Great Britain, that sort of originated with him, and it was unbelievably unpopular in his day. But I think Shakespeare's always sort of having a nod towards him and being like, yeah, unity, because that's mainly, it's all the problems in the tragedies in the histories happen when people try and divide the kingdom.
Well, Elizabeth was really an absolute monarch. She was really the start of the whole absolute monarchy for England.
Absolutely.
And it was, of course, a Europe-wide trend.
Yeah. Well, and you know, she's had to recover from Henry VIII and all of his six knives, to quote Hugh Laurie and Blackadder. Oh, Henry VIII and his six knives. But yeah, they're still recovering. Elizabeth was still recovering from sort of the Tudor dynasty and like what it meant and being separated from the Catholic Church and all of the baggage that came along with that. So it's It's a very interesting play, and I don't know, did you, my big final question to you, I mean, I know my answer, but do you find this play and its story relevant to the present day, whether it's in whatever realm, and if so, or if not, why?
How to depose a ruler.
How to depose a ruler.
That got on the throne that it turned out you didn't want him to be on the throne.
Wonder who.
History does repeat itself, though.
Absolutely.
This is definitely relevant.
Well, yes. His son would come into
play. Oh, no. Not Eric. Yeah, no, I mean, I know that I find that I've always adored the history plays almost more than any Shakespeare plays, and I think because they're just, you can really, they're so politically relevant. It's all about these changing alliances and personal relationships, and if you look at it, you know, all of these people are related, at least all of the nobility, so it's really like a family feud. It's a giant family feud that rips apart a country, but at the same time, you know, they're all related in some way, which is creepy.
Yeah.
I think like a large theme of the play is like the differences of honor between the characters.
Pretty like, Staffian answer.
So you have, like, what's in that word?
Hotspur's honor, which is based in battle, I guess. Sort of that zone. Then you have Blunt, who is very sort of based in honesty and loyalty, and then of course have Falstaff's attitude, which is not good for anything.
Yeah.
And I think that can be applied today with, like, our politics that are kind of corrupted, and we have these figures who aren't necessarily honorable.
At all!
Use words to mean whatever they want them to mean.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be constantly more about personal power, about personal gain, than it is about the country necessarily, about any of the other things. I mean, even Bolingbroke starts out as, I want my lands back, I want my personal rights back, and then it turns into going after the kingship. You kind of see that repeating again with Worcester. You know, we put you on the throne, we thought you were going to protect our interests, you're not protecting our interests, we want to kick you off.
Yeah. Absolutely. And changing relationships as well, based on political gain, which, we haven't seen that at all in the last couple of weeks at all.
Yeah, really.
I hate him! No! Yes, I think he's a great man, and
no,
blah, blah, blah.
No,
you know, it's remarkable. Yeah, I never said it. You don't have proof. It's remarkable how similar sort of the political dealings are.
That there's a one quote: "Those who do not remember the past are doomed
to
repeat it."
To repeat it. Indeed.
Even when we do remember the past,
right.
Yeah, we repeat it anyway.
This is the second time this has happened in American history. The first time was with Andrew Jackson.
Well,
and hey, we got a great musical out of that, so you know, what'll happen there. And speaking of quotes, tell me, just as a last question, what is your favorite quote from this play?
Wait, like favorite quote wise from the actual play? Or
yeah, from the actual play.
Okay.
From the play!
Coins and be hanged.
I'm not an answer.
Another
answer. Easy fat guts.
That's a good one. That's Poins, right? In the tavern scene? Mm-hmm. Or no, that's Prince Hal.
It's Prince
Hal. In the robbery scene.
I can call spirits from the vasty deep.
Yeah.
Why, so can I, and so can any other man. Will they come when you call them?
Exactly, when
you
do call them.
This is from the Desert Life Today again. I think that he learned the plays so well. And they're possibly even harder to understand now than they were then, because we don't know the language as well. But they still have meaning because of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you have to, in our culture today, Shakespeare is kind of this mythical thing. It's like, oh, it's too academic, too scholarly, too. We put these labels on it, like, oh, it's untouchable by the common people, the normal people. It's like, no. you have to work through that, work through the language, which, you know, it's archaic almost. Not really archaic, but it's different.
I would find Chaucer to be much more difficult.
Yes. But if you work through that, all these plays, there's a reason they're still here 400 years after they were written. There's some reason for that. And I think it's because they're very relevant. They've stayed relevant. Everything he's written about is something about the human condition, I'll call it, that stays with us, and it's something that we can relate to no matter what's going on.
Mm.
And every play has different elements that we can relate to. This one, trust, who to trust, who not to trust, how to honor, all that. Everything is something we can relate to. And
absolutely, I totally agree. I just, my argument is always, I don't think you can find a more humanistic writer. Ever. You know, I've read all the humanists, and I thoroughly enjoy them, Erasmus and Thomas More and everything, but there's nothing that sort of grabs you like a Shakespeare play.
It seems like Shakespeare has spent, it seems like before Shakespeare was like a living being, he spent 1,000 years watching over humankind and jotting down notes.
That's a wonderful observation. Yeah.
I mean, he seems to know more about the human race than the human race knows about itself.
That's a really wonderful, that's a wonderful line. I'm going to use that. That's a great line, man. Yeah, Jackson.
Yeah, I think that what Sterling says, like, they're here after 400 years, is you could, and you see it, like, in everything, like, a lot of stuff is based off Shakespeare plays. Like, take love stories. I think almost like every single love story is based off Romeo and Juliet. look at West Side Story. West Side Story is basically Romeo and Juliet in the hood.
The ancient Greeks said there were only 13 great plots. But this is an add-on to that. One of the reasons that we still have them today is because they get you thinking.
Yeah. They do. They absolutely
and
do.
Everyone knows we can use more of that.
I think because we're not so familiar with the language, it causes us to have to think harder about the meaning, which
it's
you're
totally
able to get more
true.
From it.
They've done these studies where they put people in MRIs and they listen to Shakespeare, and the brain actually goes through this creative process of puzzle solving.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
Cool.
All your puzzle solving centers light up.
And it forges new connections in your brain,
right.
Sort of going through and really trying to pick apart the text. It's really remarkable.
So, that's why when you see, like, Shakespeare translated into modern English, it's like,
synapses are not going to fire.
And to me, it's like, it's really a question of semantics. It's, are you doing an adaptation or are you translating it? Because I don't have a problem with adaptation. I've seen some amazing the BBC did it, or maybe it wasn't the BBC. Somebody did this amazing series called Shakespeare Retold. Which was so funny. I mean, the Taming of the Shrew has got to be like one of my favorite, with Rufus Sewell and God, what's her name? She's so brilliant. Anyway, it was like the most brilliant Taming of the Shrew, and they did it in modern English, but it was very much an adaptation, taking the plot. But when it's translation, it always seems to me to be like...
It's flat.
It's
not realizing how important the language actually is to the characters.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
More than just sounding good, it's identity in the words.
Well, and it's, I think, you know, very few of Shakespeare... I mean, we'll go on and we'll talk about The Tempest, Shakespeare, one of Shakespeare's only original storylines, but very few of his stories were original. And there's a reason we remember his version and not, you know, the novel... Rosalind, which I read the entirety of when I was doing dramaturgy for As You Like It, and I gotta say, not as good as You Like It.
So I gotta ask all you guys, when you hear a character's lines, even if you're not reading it, you don't see the name Hotspur above it, can you tell who the because they're written so differently.
Definitely.
You know what lines belong to who. You know a Blunt from a Bardolph. Absolutely.
Because they are opinionated. Everyone holds a slightly different opinion.
Absolutely.
Apart from each other, just by hearing.
And they're also, I mean, they're structured differently.
Yes.
Because every
prose and verse.
Every
know?
Character has, like, his own, like, goal. And a lot of them change in the play, but I think that you can identify because every character has a goal. And if every character has a goal, then it's easy to identify which character that is by nothing.
And somehow his language reflects.
Well, and people use similar imagery too as characters.
I think each character sort of has their own linguistical fingerprint, so you can tell
That's a great word for one linguistical fingerprint.
In this day and age, people communicate through a series of grunts and body movements. And if you're that person's friend, you know what all their various little noises mean.
It's like Robin's dog.
And so each character kind of has their own little noises that they make.
So much more sophisticated.
Their own little
sophisticated
symphony that they make.
That's wonderful. And on that note, let us end Henry IV. Thank you all so much for
being
participants.
Thank you.
Thank you.